Hi everyone, welcome to episode 10 of Prospectus's podcast. My name's Adam, I'm a senior consultant here and I focus on income generation roles with a specialism and focus on the environment conservation space with some advocacy in there as well. Environment is something I'm exceptionally passionate about, and so that's why when Florence, the director of the Environmental Funders Network, agreed to come on our podcast, I was so excited. You've got such a great conversation to look forward to. We go through different foundations, we go through different nature-based solutions, we go through our projections for the future. I mean, if you're an environmental fundraiser, you have to listen. So yeah, without further ado, say hi.
Hello, lovely to be here. Thanks so much for inviting me.
It's my pleasure. This will be part of a short series of a few conversations I'm going to have with people in the environmental space. What I am really, really happy with is the work that EFN do. And sort of first question out of the gate to you, Flo, is can you just tell us a bit about the work of EFN and how you came to work for them? You know, what's the story?
Yeah, sure. So the Environmental Funders Network was set up in 2003. And it was set up by some funders who felt frustrated that there were a lot of people funding environmental issues, but they were doing it in silos. And there wasn't a lot of understanding of who was funding what. And they had this sense that if they could bring people together, there'd be less reinventing of wheels. There'd be more strategic giving. It would be if they could start mapping out who was funding what and do some research into that to sort of reveal the funding landscape, that it might help reveal some gaps that weren't being filled. Yeah. And uncover duplication. So that was, in, as I said, in 2003, and I think there were about six foundations that came to the table for the first meeting, and it's just sort of grown steadily since then. And it's got a sort of two-part mission. One is to try and improve the effectiveness of environmental philanthropy, and the other part is that the research that they then started to undertake to map out what was being funded from all the UK-based trusts and foundations that give to environmental causes, that research revealed like very little funding for environmental causes overall. So it was averaging about £100 million a year for a long time, 105, 115, anywhere around there.
Out of what size of pie? So 100 million out of?
Well, I mean, overall philanthropic giving, that we're talking like 3% of overall philanthropic giving.
Yeah.
And, you know, so given that the environment underpins pretty much everything, life on Earth, including humans, and our economic system, etc., this struck everybody as being really remarkably little. So we have this second part of our mission, which is to try to grow the pie and increase the amounts of funding going to environmental causes. We do not wish to do this at the expense of the other causes, all of which we think are hugely important. So the idea is to start bringing new money. I mean, there's plenty of money that could be going philanthropically that's not yet. So the idea is to bring in new money and also to help people understand the interconnections between environmental and social issues, that you can't really address one without the other. The same goes, of course, for environmental funding, that they all, anyone funding environmental issues needs to be cognizant of the social issues and how they can be addressing both, depending on what issue you're talking about. So those are the sort of two pieces of our work, effectiveness and increasing environmental philanthropy. And you said,
how did you get involved? Yeah, that was such an interesting question of sort of origin story. Where did you get involved? How did you come about? How did you come about working for EFN?
Yeah, so I had gone to the States to do a master's in environmental science. I'd always wanted to do environmental work, and I'd worked briefly at the Environmental Change Institute in the UK in Oxford after graduating from university. I'd gone to the States to do my master's, and then I'd ended up staying. So I'd worked for WWF in the States and a small kind of social justice environmental charity called Center for Whole Communities. And then eventually had wound up working for National Audubon Society, which is the BirdLife International partner in the States, a bit like the RSPB over there. Yeah. So I'd worked there giving out grants. So I was housed within a conservation charity, but I was giving money out as grants. And that kind of got my foot in the door of philanthropy and then moved back to the UK for this job. And I really could not have come up with a better job for moving to the UK and very quickly getting to grips with the environment sector, sort of getting a really privileged bird's eye view of everything going on.
Yeah.
And so I've ended up staying in this job for far longer than I ever thought I would. That was in 2012, so it's been quite a long time.
That's great, though. That's great. It sounds like a really interesting story. I'm seeing both sides of the pie, sort of where what money's used as it comes in, and then how the challenges charities face when they're applying for grants. Because you have big charities which can apply very well for lots of big pots of money, but then most charities are small, sort of sub 2 million, who maybe don't have a specialist to apply for these big grants.
That's right.
And I think the work of EFN is really exciting in that area. So 2020, big year for everybody. It was a challenge, it was a challenge for a prospectus. I'm sure it's a challenge for EFN in many ways, finding out new ways of working. I think we're all starting to get Facebook memories on our phones, and we're all starting to remember what happened sort of in the months after we all sort of went home. But for environmental charities, some have fared better than others. It's sort of been a bit of a mixed picture. What do you think has been the impact on environmental and sort of climate focused charities over the course of the last sort of 12, 14 months?
I think it's been, as you say, it's been a very mixed bag. So we convened, we have a sort of informal green fundraisers forum where we bring together fundraisers from across the sector, and we convene them quite regularly to hear what their needs are, and then be able to, we can reflect that back to funders. But we also kind of provided training during the pandemic. So what does fundraising mean? How can you maximize the moment now in terms of fundraising? Those sorts of things. So what we're hearing is what some organizations have really struggled, and organizations like the National Trust, for example, which really relies on membership income and people coming to their sites and spending money at their cafes. And anyone that has visitor sites, for example, which is quite a lot of conservation organizations, has taken a massive hit, obviously, like the rest of the sort of service sector. Other organizations have found it hasn't yet impacted their income, or perhaps their income has even grown, but everyone seems to be quite worried about the long-term impact on their income. So the whole kind of flow of grants through the system seized up because a lot of funders just decided, okay, in 2020, we're going to focus on our current grantees and support them best we can, which was brilliant. And a lot of them made their funding unrestricted, super flexible, relaxed their reporting requirements, everything they could to help the grantees use the money as effectively as possible in a period of crisis. But what it meant was even if you were one of those grantees, inevitably you were thinking, okay, so next year we're going to apply to so and so. But of course that is uncertain now. No
Yeah,
one's
no,
quite
of
sure
course.
when systems will get back into the sort of normal flow of
Yeah.
foundations opening up. So I
And
think the
would you
uncertainty
say,
is hard.
yeah, just on that, because I've heard some reflections from trusts and foundations managers and people who've been involved, and I thought a secondary concern that a lot of people have had is that a lot of the trusts and foundations that give out five, four, five, and small six figure grants are very much are giving out more than they would typically, sort of reducing the amount of capital which they have to have in general, which means that in the future they're just going to be giving out less because they're going to have less to spend because of how much money they've spent out of their reserve. Are you seeing that as part of the story as well, or is that just sort of in only in small places?
So it's funny because we surveyed our members recently and we did ask them all the things they were doing differently as a result of the pandemic, and we gave a whole checklist which included giving out more money, et cetera, et cetera. Most of the ones who responded said along the lines of the things like making their funding less, more flexible, unrestricted, longer term. Most of them said, well, we were kind of doing all of this already. On
That's
the
good.
I'm slightly waffling because I can't remember the answer around increasing their funding. Wish I had the
That's
spreadsheet
right.
in front of me. I
Yeah.
think some of them have tapped into, I mean, I can think of a couple of foundations off the top of my head who have tapped into their sort of corpus to start giving out more. My feeling is that foundations should be bold right now. I mean, especially when you're talking about the climate and biodiversity
Yeah.
crisis, why sit on the money and spend it in 20 years' time? We have to spend it now because the window of
Yeah.
opportunity for addressing these crises is right now and it's closing very rapidly. And there's so much money in the system, more money will come forwards. It's not like your foundation is the only foundation that can solve the crisis. Other ones will be inspired to come forward by whatever you do now. So I kind of sense, my sense is Funders need to be bold right now. We need to be confident that there will be more generosity in the future, and the weight of the whole world is not on our shoulders, but it is on our shoulders in terms of us having to act right now.
A great call to action. Love that. Love that so much. I think it's so great. And, you know, I'm sure there'll be people listening to this, and I'm sure there are other people who you'll talk to in other conversations who'll meet that call to arms. We can only hope, especially with COP26 coming up in Glasgow, you know, this year is the year to be bold and to act big, because, you know, if we don't act now, then, you know, our little blue and green lifeboat will no longer be a lifeboat for us, which is a nice analogy. So, you know, you mentioned a little bit earlier in your answers, you know, only 3%, you know, green grants went 7%. I think it was produced reflecting on 2016 from memory. And, you know, it said that, you know, as you say, 100 million to the sector. You know, what's been the story of that percentage number from sort of then to today? Is it growing? Is it stable? What's going on there?
Yeah, so that research tracks all the UK trusts and foundations that give to environmental causes, as far as we know. And we do look at almost 200 foundations and categorise all their giving. And the last report went up to 2016. It was actually the 4 years running up to 2016. Okay. And as you said, it was about 105 million going out. Mm. Our sense now is that it has at least doubled, possibly tripled since then. Wow. That is mostly because of one very large new entrant to the sector, and then significantly increased giving from the Children's Investment Fund Foundation. So the numbers have got much bigger. That money is obviously not available to the whole sector. The larger givers, by necessity, tend to give out much larger grants. So obviously you're talking about a relatively small pool of organisations that can take on that money. It definitely is a huge influx of money. It's not necessarily going to be available to your average small environmental charity.
So I remember we'd done an event, it feels like an age ago now, in person, where we brought together I think 40 green fundraisers, had presentations from Esme Fairbairn, John Ellerman Foundation, I think is the foundation you're referring to, Quadrature Climate Foundation, as well as the new entrant to the market. They've come in, and they're now funding with Jake, I'll just name drop a little, and Jake Heyman and the Impatience Earth program, which I think is a brilliant innovation. And you've also got other bits and pieces happening, which is fantastic. And so you think it's tripled. That's pretty good. Fair to say, in the last few years, the percentage figure may not. You think the percentage figure's gone up as well? So the amount of money and the percentage must have gone up as well.
Yeah, I mean, I can't reflect on the broader sector because I have no data for whether. I would imagine giving has gone up during the crisis for social issues. The pandemic, you can only imagine. So maybe they've both grown and the proportion has stayed the same.
But great. Look, I will take it. That sounds fantastic. And so you think the reasons around it, a couple of new entrants to the market. I know sort of Esme has recruited a director of natural giving, I think, or something along those lines.
Yeah, so and Esme has increased their giving over recent years. Arcadia Fund has increased theirs to the environment. So yeah, I mean, there are several big foundations that are really ramping things up, which is brilliant.
Amazing. We love to see it. And, you know, what hopefully this does is give charities the opportunity to collaborate more, and to bring people together on different programs and projects and other bits and pieces, so you can try and create, you know, real collaborations which enhance the impact of donors and what they can do. I'd be curious to see what examples have you seen recently of where this has been done well, and does EFN do any work in this sort of area to bring charities together to collaborate on bids to foundations, or, you know, with foundations design programs for multiple charities to apply for?
So it's interesting because we the other side of our research, apart from tracking grants, is to survey the chief executives of environment groups to find out kind of quantitatively where are they getting their money from and how are they spending it, so we can get a picture of like flow what through. Proportion of their money comes from trusts and foundations, from the public, from legacies and so on. But then what are they spending it on? So you can understand what issues that all the different charities are focusing on, and then the kinds of approaches that they're using, because we ask them to break down their expenditure by approach. Yeah. But then the other pieces are more qualitative. What do you think the sector needs to become much more effective? So we can sort of gather the collective intelligence of the environmental kind of movement. So we did that in 2013 and then again in 2016. And the first time we did it, we ended up calling the report Passionate Collaboration. There was a question mark. but it was because there was this call, there was a real sense that when the sector had collaborated really well, it had been at its most effective. And when it had failed to collaborate, you know, the inverse, it had not done so well. And I feel like in the years since then, collaboration has absolutely been on the rise within the environment sector.
Great.
And there are some examples of really effective ones, like Greener UK, which was housed within Green Alliance, but brought together, I can't remember how many, maybe 13 different NGOs. Great. That arose to respond to the need, the jeopardy to UK environmental protections posed by Brexit.
Yeah,
and that was a really remarkable collaboration. You know, they were totally on top of things. Before the referendum, in fact, they were coming together regularly, and then it turned into a pretty powerful kind of force for keeping an eye on and developing ideas for policy and the kind of mechanisms we need to protect to sort of enforce policy in the UK. So that has been really impressive. There are loads of others. You know, since the pandemic started, there's been a whole kind of Build Back Better coalition that's emerged. That brings together environment and social justice groups and new economy groups. So there's just a lot, and COP26 has loads of coalitions around it. There's the COP26 coalition, there's the climate coalition. So there's loads of kind of collaborative work going on in the sector. On the funder side, that's kind of one of the goals of EFN, is if we can build relationships between funders, develop trust between them, help them get to know each other well enough that collaborations can emerge between them, that is fantastic. And that happens quite regularly. So there are funders who end up aligning their strategies on whether it's nature-based solutions to climate change or food and agriculture, sustainable food and agriculture. So there are groups. There's a group that is pooling funds called Farming Future on that front. And a lot of those have come from our EFN members who've developed that. What are some other funder collaboratives? I mean, it's interesting, in terms of funder collaboration, you get some really huge international ones where the really heavy hitters are pooling money to phase out coal and super strategic. At the smaller level, you kind of have to be in a collaboration with organizations that are of a similar size to you. I think a smaller funder would find it hard to think, well, why would I put £50,000 into something with millions from others? So I kind of, there's this, a couple of criteria for collaborating effectively. And one of them is either being similar sizes or being super complementary.
Yeah.
And the other one is a kind of values set. You've got to have quite similar values. What everyone thinks of as a win in the environment sector is very varied, and we don't necessarily talk about that very much.
Yeah.
There are very, you know, obviously you've got kind of technological approaches, like technology will fix everything. Yeah. And then you've got the, like, no, actually we need to transform our whole systems, the capitalist system needs to be transformed. So it's like a huge variation. And I think funders need to kind of feel their way into who's occupies similar territory to them before a collaboration is likely to be particularly effective.
That's fascinating, because there are so many different people in the space doing so many different things. There's such a spectrum, you know, all the way from sort of your Greenpeace and more direct action focused organizations, all the way to, you know, National Trust and Campaign to Protect Rural England, all the way on the other side, which is, you know, very much more on a more conservatorial, you know, we need to preserve what we've got kind of area, and everyone in between. And WWF is a good example. You know, they've had a bit of a bumper year with, you know, people focusing on wanting to preserve nature, and so growing their individual giving to a large degree, and looking at employing people who are focused on specialists for systems change, food system change, energy system change, all this other stuff, which is brilliant to see. And, you know, large charities like that convening people together is kind of half of what we need. And
well, Adam, what are the collaborations you've seen that you've been most excited by?
So I was going to bring this up a little bit later, but the one I listened to the Blue Marine podcast yesterday on my walk in the sunshine. It was delightful, and they were talking about how oysters are a nature-based solution, and so it's a collaboration between British Yachting, Blue Marine, and the Marina Trade Body, which has been brought together with different bits of funding from Zoological Society of London and another body, where their whole focus is on rebuilding oyster beds. Because around the UK, we used to have a plethora of oyster reefs all around, which would purify water. They would store carbon. They would get rid of nitrogen out of the ocean, which stops acidification in the oceans as well. And in London, there used to be a million oysters eaten a day because it was a really cheap, easy to find. Source of nutrition, and now none of the beds which we had for thousands and thousands of years, which built up over thousands and thousands of years, are now gone. And so there's a project in Southampton Solent, which is amazing. There's a project up in the Humber called Nora, which I've forgotten what that stands for. There's a project in Essex. There are now sister projects in America, in New York's harbour. And I think there's these kind of sort of nature-based solutions that I love. I absolutely love. And it's those kind of collaborations that we love to see, because it's all about growing the size of the pie, for all environmental charities to fund the programs and the nature-based solutions that will prevent the climate catastrophe. If we look at the science, as we've said earlier, you know, acting now is a priority. So, you know, for you, looking to the future, and who is working in the space, what do you think are some of the best ways the sector can work together to achieve this sort of growing of the overall funding pie for the prevention of climate catastrophe, really?
I mean, that's sort of it's the £1 billion question, isn't it?
Literally. Hopefully trillion.
Yeah, exactly. But we're like, our somewhat modest but also stretching goal is to try and increase the amount of funding going to environmental causes to £1 billion a year from what was 105 million by 2025.
That's
so
not bad.
We ask ourselves the question you've just posed me all the time, like, what needs to be done? And from our perspective, there's sort of a growing ecosystem of organizations that are devoted to this. So you mentioned Impatience Earth, which Quadrature Climate Foundation have funded, and they are providing free, because QCF pays for it, bespoke advice to anyone who's willing to give more than £100,000 a year or thereabouts on climate to help them develop their strategy. And that is absolutely fantastic. Then there's the Climate Leadership Initiative, which is targeted on the kind of uber wealthy potential givers at a really high level. And they provide a huge amount of resources and networking for people at that level to sort of develop their strategy. And then we operate kind of in tandem with both of them. There's also Active Philanthropy in Germany, which does something similar. I'm sure there are others that I'm not even aware of yet. So we have kind of regular meetings with all of those to figure out who's doing what. But from the point of view of the sector, I genuinely think one thing that would be revolutionary is changing how we talk about environmental issues. So the framing piece seems to me incredibly important in terms of how we are capturing people's imaginations and how we are making it clear that we can address these issues. I think there's a lot. So the general public mood went from a sort of vague state of denial about climate change to hopping over the bit in the middle where everyone accepted that it was happening and like we needed to do something about it, but hopping straight into, well, it's such an enormous issue, we can't really do anything about it. So we kind of went, well, I mean, this is totally oversimplifying things.
Yes,
but I have the sense that we went from a sort of state of denial into a state of defeatism. And I think that's our fault from the environment sector. If we're talking about the scale of the challenge, but we're not talking about solutions and what can be done, and the fact that it's perfectly within our power to address these enormous issues, then of course people are going to feel defeated. I mean, I regularly do myself if I let myself go down that route.
Yeah, we all do.
Yeah, there's some really clear research about how you talk about these things in a way that makes people feel empowered and that we can do something and it's worth doing something. And so I think that's the first step, is everyone in their fundraising efforts needs to be very clear on how you're communicating about it in ways that does not prompt a sense of defeatism from the recipient of that proposal. And that's not just grant funding from trusts and foundations, but that's how we're getting money out of the public and getting the public's kind of input into all of this. Yeah, I think there's a real sense that this is a huge challenge and I'm being asked to give a few quid and turn out my lights. That those two things are really not, like, there's huge disconnect, isn't there? And people sense that, and that it feels like pointless. What's the point in doing this? So I think there needs to be a bigger call to action for people. It's about putting a lot of money into the system, but it's also about something much bigger than that. It's about engaging people everywhere they are in all aspects of their lives, so that they're becoming, I don't want to say activists, because activist is an off-putting word for some people, but they become,
sort of different connotations, doesn't it, to some people?
But they're taking action at every level. So you're engaged. I would love it if people felt, by dint of giving their tenor or whatever it is to an environmental charity, that they also felt empowered to engage with their local council or with the business practices of their employers. All of these things which feel much more meaningful than only giving a little bit of money or only switching out your lights or like not taking a bag or whatever it may be.
Yeah, we kind of had, because I you know, over the last few years there has been a real change in sense, so that it feels to me that we went very quickly, and this might have been to do with, you know, Extinction Rebellion, it might have been to do with the Blue Planet effect, and then Blue Planet 2, and then the other day, whatever else, David Attenborough then went on to do, including his most recent call to action, which I have to say, I went to the cinema and came out and was, oh, this is a sense of, like, you know, action must be taken. Obviously, David Attenborough can't be a lone soldier in all of this. Not really a military analogy, but he can't be a lone person standing up for the environmental space. You know, we do need a few more champions like that. And so, you think the call to action is talking about nature-based solutions, talking about what changes can you make, and how you as a person can contribute, rather than being that sort of activist, but your contribution to the environment?
Yeah, I think what this requires of all of us is a really significant change, and that change is very scary for people and not particularly appealing. But right now we have a moment where everyone realizes that we do need a significant change. The pandemic sort of enhanced that, heightened that sense of, God, we want change at this point. So I think now we need to just make it easy for people to show, and not only easy but appealing. And that's where I think we fall down as a sector, is the environment movement came out of a strong sense of sort of justice and stopping bad things from happening. And despite years of people saying, we've got to stop saying I have a nightmare and start saying I have a dream, we still haven't articulated that dream very clearly. And that I'm longing for it. I'm longing for someone to articulate that vision. And I think all of us probably need to spend some more time fleshing it out.
Interesting.
So that we can turn to people and say, look, this is what we're inviting you towards, not what we're stopping you from doing.
Well, it's kind of like with the I was looking at a few bits and pieces on the Amazon. The Amazon's been under threat for the last 50 years. Like it's been the same sort of terminology around saving the Amazon rainforest for the last 50 years, and yet it's not worked yet. And so there does feel that there needs to be a bit of a shift in thinking, or a shift in the way the space talks about it, to actually have an impact and to have a direct effect on what's happening. And, you know, to bring us off, I'm curious. I spoke about my favorite nature-based climate solution with rebedding the oyster reefs around the United Kingdom and around the world as a way of, you know, being a carbon store, preventing the acidification of the oceans and creating microclimates. I could literally go on forever. I love it. I think it's a great idea. But what for you do you think is, you know, maybe not your favorite, but maybe a nature-based solution that you like the look of, or you think's maybe not got the press it deserves, or one that you just think is interesting?
So I guess the first thing that popped into my head when you, because you had sent me that list of questions just before the call, so I scanned through it, and the first thing that came into my head, so I'll go with that because obviously that's my gut, was around how to go about regenerating the land. And so I've just been reviewing lots of proposals that came in for a fund, and there were so many focused on tree planting.
Yes, there's a lot.
Tons of tree planting. And I don't know if you know NEP, the NEP estate, which has become very well known because they've rewilded it. And Isabella Tree, who's one of the owners, wrote a very successful book called Wilding. Nice. So they produce videos that they call NEP Netflix. And they have a short video on tree planting, and it essentially lays out the traditional method, which involves, you know, often spraying glyphosate to kill everything else off, and then and then you plant all your trees, and you need quite a lot of machinery if you're doing this at scale, and then you wrap them all in plastic protectors because otherwise grazers will get them, blah blah blah, and it's very intensive and produces a lot of plastic and probably carbon emissions from all your vehicles, etc. And it's expensive. And the NEP approach was essentially, as anyone who's read Wilding would already know, to get some sort of animal, whether it's, you know, longhorn cattle. I'm never entirely sure why the longhorns are necessary. I don't quite get that.
Yeah.
But they use pigs, they use Tamworth pigs because they weren't allowed to bring in wild boar, that kind of rummage around and dig up the soil and produce these exposed areas where seeds can take root, brambles develop, they protect anything else that's growing within them because grazers, no grazers can get through them. Yeah. And then trees regenerate like that. And you end up with a thorny scrub that is incredibly diverse. And it costs almost no money, except obviously you potentially need to fence off a large area to stop grazers coming in the early days, produce no carbon emissions, and ultimately creates really biodiverse and carbon sequestering.
That's incredible. I love that. It's definitely on the reading list now, I tell you. And great. Well, it's that. And then, you know, I'm loving the amount of, whether it's the wildlife trusts or the beaver trust or a few of the others who are just reintroducing beavers. I swear I get BBC News push notifications all the time. So beavers been reintroduced to Wales, Scotland, this, that, the other.
Yeah.
I think it's those kind of nature-based solutions, just like the one you just went through, that will be the you know, don't want to say there's no silver bullet by any stretch. There needs to be 1,000 solutions all working in tandem together, all nature-based, whether it's oysters or beavers or, you know, getting pigs that look like wild boars to do the work of machinery. I think there is hope. You know, I think one thing the environmental sector, like you say, is a bit guilty of sometimes is talking about the size of the problem, the scale of it, you know, and the challenges that everyone faces, and how, you know, we're talking in millions and billions and trillions of tons of carbon, and how are we going to solve this? And I think it is about identifying small solutions that are recognizable in everyday life, and, you know, maybe identifying smaller charities. You know, I give money to the Whale and Dolphin Conservation Society, Blue Marine, to their oyster projects, you know, smaller charities where I think my £10-20 a month is going to make at least a little bit more impact to these nature-based solutions. And, you know, I think if there's a rallying cry to this from this podcast, it's, you know, give more, do more, bring people together, try and act as a convener as much as you can. Is there anything you want to leave our listeners with?
I guess what I was getting at in terms of being people being more active as well as giving money, I think the money is obviously super important. Otherwise, I wouldn't work with the Environmental Fund Network. I think it can power charge, turbocharge environmental initiatives that otherwise might not get off the ground. The action piece is that if you can start seeing some successes locally in your life, you feel so much more empowered. All of this becomes much more doable. So if you were to restore a patch of land where you live, or make changes in the policy in your organization where you work, you know, you start to have a sense of, yeah, we can do this. Change is absolutely possible. And maybe that will feed into giving more money to organizations that are affecting change. So I think it's a sort of, there's a positive feedback loop there. Nice. That's really important. And it's really important for our mental health as well to be involved in stuff that's making change for the better. I think we're all desperate for anything that improves mental health at this point in the pandemic. And I couldn't recommend being involved with environmental causes more for that. It's very... gives you an incredible sense both of you're achieving something, but also you're doing it with others in a sort of sense of community. You have a sense of community. And that is brilliant.
Amazing. Well, that's so good. And I think, I don't think there's a better point to end on, really. You know, taking those small actions which you see then flourish around, you know, whether it's, you know, moving your business over to a more environmentally friendly sitting, maybe changing where your pension is, maybe changing where, you know, what you do on a weekend to go and plant some trees in what hopefully is going to be a brilliant summer we have. Amazing. God, that was a brilliant conversation, Flo. Thank you so much for your time. And thank you, everyone, for listening.
Oh, thanks so much for having me, Adam. Real pleasure.
My pleasure.